Okay, let's start. I can put on two hats as the program chair. I can say the next speaker is Ron Fox, and he'll be talking about slow controls for experimental nuclear physics. And I take that hat off and say, hi, I'm Ron Fox, and my talk will be about slow controls for experiments in nuclear physics. Again, although I'm wearing the NSCL t-shirt, this is not an NSCL talk. This is work done for a bunch of people just down the road from here at Oregon State University. And I want to thank Walt Loveland for funding this project, or for providing funding from his funding for this project, rather. Okay, so what are we going to talk about? First of all, what do I mean by a slow control system? It's probably important to kind of lay out what that means in the context of a nuclear physics experiment, and the same terminology is used in high-energy physics experiments, so if you ever get stuck in a high-energy conference, then a lot of these words will have the same meaning. Hello? Oh, there we go. The requirements and desirements I tried to meet to make this system work for these guys. I'm going to give the information I got from the group about what they wanted and see, and kind of also give what I extracted from this. And the data model implemented, the data model that I used to drive this thing, which is implemented as a pair of Medicare databases. And towards the end, I'll talk about how the whole thing turned out, including screenshots and customer satisfaction. And I'll include myself as a customer because I think that there are things that I did wrong and maybe worth talking about those as well as the things that came out right. Okay, so what is a slow control system? Well, first of all, what's an experiment in nuclear physics? These are kind of the blocks you see in, from the software point of view, in a nuclear physics experiment. There's some detector package, some analog electronics, digitization, readout. Detectors usually get high voltage stuck on them, and there may be gas handling detectors for gas systems, for gas detectors. How do these things all fit together? What is the flow of data amongst these unconnected boxes? Well, the one I'm usually interested in, as I do data acquisition software, is the main data flow, and that's the flow of signals from the detector package. I think Danielle talked about that as he talked about the chain of observation in his talk on SPECT-EK. There's the flow of signal through analog electronics and conditioning, through digitization, through the readout system, and then not shown here is the continuation of this flow into online analysis and online recording. We're not going to talk about that. That's not slow control. There's also what you might call high-speed control or trigger logic, depending on who you talk to, where what is happening is this analog electronics communicates with some digital electronics that makes some selection to decide whether or not digitization should take place and eventually to tell you whether and when to start reading things out. I'm calling this high-speed control. It's often called trigger logic. It's often called discrimination. It depends on who you talk to. We're not going to talk about that either. What we are going to talk about is the digital electronics in this picture, and in some cases analog electronics, I haven't shown that, and gas handling and bias supplies often now are remotely controllable, which is a really nice thing. It means you can put the whole electronics package close to the experiment, not have to deal with very long signal runs from the radiation shielded area of the experiment out to where you can actually start twisting knobs and things. You can compact this thing very close, get good signal quality from detector out through analog electronics and so on. I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about building a system that allows you to do this control, this control of the parameters of digital electronics, gas handling systems, bias supplies, in some cases analog electronics as well. There are some characteristics of slow control systems as they're used for these experiments. They're set infrequently. Usually you're kind of twiddling them around for a while, you get them set up the way you want, and then you start running a production run without changing settings very much. Or you may do a group of runs with one set of settings, and then as you move to another regime of the experiment, you may then make a bunch of changes, retune the system, and then you're just going to let it sit there. So the settings are a condition of the experiment rather than something that you're actively sitting there and tuning as the experiment is being run. They're monitored continuously in many cases. For example, a high voltage power supply that's supplying bias in a gas detector. You may have a case where you'll have a breakdown in the gas, and all of a sudden the increased current flow will make the power supply decide that it really shouldn't be biasing the detector anymore, so that the detector doesn't get destroyed. And then you need to know that that's happened so that you can say, oh, I guess it's time to switch on the detector. Or alternatively, if this is happening a lot, maybe I need to look at why the detector is breaking down all the time. You have to be able to get to previously established good settings after breaks or after excursions off into some a bad tuning path. There are two reasons you might have to go back here. One is nuclear particle accelerators are notoriously unreliable. Danielle is laughing. He's been there and lived this. They break. They break down, and then you have this long delay before you get beam on target that's usable. When that happens, when you're in that state where you're not using it, it may be sometimes a good idea to power down your detectors so you're not aging them. It may be a good idea not to waste gas on gas detectors because you've got this bottle that's got to last through the whole experiment, and there's no point in flowing it if you're not using it. So after you're done, you got to go back to some good settings. So you have to be able to save and restore settings of this thing. Another characteristic is these things tend to be an ad hoc collection of things that are interfaced to the computer system in a very wide variety of ways. And there are these, what people will do is use expedience to choose the module rather than some particular system design of we will standardize on this bus. What they do is they grab a module that looks like it's going to work for them, and then we get to figure out how to control it. That's okay. That works. Okay, I believe that there are really three users of slow control systems. There's not three roles of users in slow control systems. First of all, there's system integrators. That's a guy like me. A system integrator is responsible for providing support at the device level for a new piece of hardware that you're controlling. Okay, all slow control systems, I think, should cater to the needs of these three user groups. There's also a group I'd call the experiment designer. And these are the guys who plan what the electronics is going to look like and what is going to be controlled, and to some extent maybe how it's going to be controlled or how it's going to be run, but really they're mostly figuring out what components they're going to use to control the experiment. And then there are these shift operators, and they're the guys that sit in front of the experiment at 3 in the morning with a slice of pizza in one hand and their hand, hopefully their hand not continuously on the control knob, the other hand. Okay, so what did I hear from Loveland's group? What they said is that they said, well, you know, I just wanted to control some discriminators. Discriminators are something that will take an analog signal and tell you whether it's noise or something useful. I don't really want to have to program this thing. I want you to do all the programming for me. Oops. I really can't tell you what the setup will be like because I've got to design the darn thing and figure it out from experiment to experiment. Maybe later we'll add more types of things that we'll want to control. That'd be good to be able to do. And of course, the shift operators say, I got to be able to run this thing with my slice of pizza in one hand. So it's got to be easy to use on shift as well. So what did I extract from this? It's got to be open and especially extensible and easy to extend. Experimenters, the experiment designer, has to be able to quickly define the electronics without any detailed knowledge of how the electronics is controlled. They don't want to program, after all. Control panels ought to be generated automatically from the definition or the design of the experiment. Because, again, there's this requirement of we don't want to program the thing, so we're not going to make them do that. That would not meet their desirement. And, of course, they didn't tell me, but I know full well that they're going to want to be able to record and restore settings for this thing. Okay, so we get to the design and implementation of this thing. So I'm going to structure this a little bit from the point of view of each of the people, each of the roles that people take in the system. What does a system integrator have to do to make this thing work? Well, I think I'm going to try to go quicker. If a module has got some new interconnection scheme, you've got to be able to describe how to address modules in that scheme. Okay, The driver software that talks to the given module, the particular module, has to be supplied by the integrator. And then I'm going to require that the system integrator build a control panel that can build itself into a TK frame for the module and use the driver that they've built to control a device given its address. And then they're going to have to provide some naming for all of these things so that the user can say, I want this module by name, and I want it to have this set of addresses. Okay, so I decided to break up the database. This is a data-driven application. I decided to break the database up into two pieces. One is a piece that the system integrator is concerned with, and this piece is basically concerned with describing the kinds of modules that are supported. And that's a centralizable thing. That's not something that changes from experiment to experiment. It's something that, I need to support this new chunk of hardware, this new bus. I make my driver and I make appropriate changes to this database. This guy here is something which is experiment specific. There's one instance per experiment that describes the set of modules that are being used and where they live in the interconnection scheme. And also, it's a handy place to save these settings that have to be restored later. The system database is made up of three tables. The two key tables are this module types table, instrumentation buses table. The module type table allows you to make a named module. There's an automatically assigned unique ID, which is used to form a connection to the experiment database tables. There's a bus type, which connects you to this instrumentation buses table. The instrumentation buses table has got a bus name or interconnection scheme name. And again, a unique ID assigned by the system when you make the bus. And then for each of these instrumentation bus entries, and people who are tickle database aware are now going to start to cringe, and I'll come back to this. For each entry in this table, there are essentially an ordered set of entries in the bus address fields table that give you, for each bus type and each addressing field, a field name and some validation information. In this case, the schema restricts you to buses which have numerical addresses. And again, that's a mistake, I think, and we'll come back to that when I say why I'm dissatisfied. Here's an example module definition. This is a discriminator that lives in a VME bus. We said all we were going to say about VME buses before lunch. It's been assigned a unique module type of 10. It lives in a VME bus here, which was assigned a unique bus ID of 5. The VME bus has got two addressing fields which are important, chassis number, or crate number, as they're called, and then some base address. There's a system limitation that says there can only be 8 crates in this system, and then it's a 32-bit address that we're going to use. So that's what these low and high limits mean. Okay, so here's a piece of the GUI the system integrator might use to define a new bus or to change the characteristics of an existing bus. To define a new bus. You can fill in a new field name and its low and high limit, low and high addressing limits, except that it gets added to this TK table. If you click on one of these fields, then the information about the field is loaded in here, so you can modify, you can correct mistakes. And then if you have one of these guys selected, you can also move it up and down, change the ordering with those little arrow buttons. And I'm not going to say anything more about. I'm not going to give the details of other GUIs the other GUI components, because they basically have the same interaction mechanism. And I'm told I'm running out of time too. Defining modules, same idea. The difference is this: you select the bus from a pull down, which is stocked from the database. And once you've these are module types. Okay, experimental designer. Oops, one back here is. Got to select the modules that you're using and assign them to locations in the buses in which they live. Their piece of the experimental database looks like a set of modules that have module names that they assign, unique module IDs which are unique within the experiment, and a module type which points back to the system-specific database, and then the actual values of module addresses for each field in that bus. Okay, here's an example. Same kind of thing as before. And here's something the experiment designer will see. These are all modules they've selected and names for them. One guy might be called a ring one discriminator. It's a KNV812. Module types can be dropped down here. The module types are stocked from the database. When you've selected a module type, this bottom part here gives you the set of addresses that you need to fill in, address fields you need to fill in, and validation is done based on the low and high limits for each of those address fields. Okay, saving and restoring. I think I'm going to skip most of this, but suffice to say, each of these modules has a different set of things it needs to save and restore, and so I needed a device-independent representation. I chose property lists, which are essentially lists of name-value pairs that I can ask the driver to supply me and ask the driver to absorb to restore the module. So this gives me a storable form that can pretty much store anything. Representing settings, I'm going to leave that alone. What does the shift operator see? The shift operator sees a GUI that consults the experiment configuration database and builds an experiment control panel that looks like this. So this is a BLT tab notebook. I left the tear-off enabled, so if somebody says, you know, I really need to look at this one module all the time, they can tear it off and do that. And you know, these things are built, these things are SNIT mega widgets with which must implement an interface that has a save and restore property list thing to be able to support the save and restore. We're almost getting there. I might make it in time. These are the save and restore dialogues. The settings have names, a comment, and a timestamp that tells you when they were last created. The only difference between these dialogues is that when you're creating one, you have to give a name and a comment. If you give an existing one, as usual, you sure you want to overwrite the existing named setting. Otherwise, you just select the guy. Okay, what worked well about this? Well, I think the property list representation, thanks. The property list representation was a very good choice. It allowed me to isolate the overall structure of the system from and how to store and save settings from what the modules actually needed to save and restore. The automated derivation of a control panel, people liked that. They didn't have to figure out how to make control panels. It was just driven from their configuration. SNIT widgets worked very, very well. Let's see. Will is not here, but again, I'll sing his praises for making SNIT mega widgets work. A database, in this case, I didn't talk much about it, but there's an isolation database of SNIT objects that isolate you from the Medicaid database with a set of application-specific canned queries. And I think that worked well because if I ever say, well, Medicaid isn't quite what I want, I can slide another database under that just by rewriting that layer. So that was nice. Things I would change. If I were doing it again, right now I calculate the package names from the module type names, and I don't think that's right. I'd put the package names in the database. I would remove the requirement that address fields be integers. For example, there are Ethernet power supplies, and you'd really like to be able to say this power supply is ps1.nscl.msu.edu, and this restriction of a numerical fields doesn't let you do that. That would also affect how validation is done, and in that case I would probably have validation either select scripts or store scripts in the database, which makes this database a little more tickle-like. I'd want to think a little bit about the fact that there's sometimes several hardware interfaces of the same bus type. We use two CAMEC bus interfaces at the NSCL, and the module is still sitting in CAMEC, but you have to select a different bus driver. So a way to layer these driver modules for that's actually experiment-specific is something I'd have to think about. And the thing I didn't mention here is the database construction I chose is very much classical database and doesn't take advantage of what Tickle can do. And so I think if I were restructuring the database, I would say that where I used multiple table entries to provide an ordered list of things, I would just put a Tickle list in there and make things much, much simpler. I did add that. Okay. That was something I wanted to add last night. Okay. Any questions? Oops. There you go. Sure.
Oop, it almost got away. Oh, you need this too. Oh, yes.
I have a question about the size of the storage.
Very small. The typical number of modules for experiments of the scale we're talking about is tens is large. And the settings then will, a typical setting then might be a few hundred items. So pretty small.